Hello, I am Eli Adachi, Professor of Medical Science at Brown University and host of Medscape One on One. Joining me today is Dr. Arthur Kaplan, the Emanuel and Robert Hart Director of the Center for Bioethics and the Sidney D. Kaplan Professor of Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. An internationally renowned bioethicist, Dr. Kaplan has taken on many of the thorny issues of our time. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We have learned last year that an NIH-funded study dating back to 1946 or thereabouts subjected vulnerable, apparently unknowing Guatemalans to sexually transmitted infections. What is and is not known at this time about this unfortunate episode?
Well, you know, a lot is not known. We're talking about an experiment that was conducted 60 years ago in a very underdeveloped country with poor records, not a lot of, means to record what took place because the nature of the populations, a prison, a home for the mentally impaired, very difficult to get a true handle on what took place. What we do know is that people were deliberately infected with disease and that the attempt was made to see whether penicillin, the new wonder drug of its time, could be used in different doses to treat their gonorrhea or their other venereal diseases. It's becoming clear that the Guatemalan government at higher levels collaborated in this study. The study was done with their knowledge. And what I find most interesting is this. It's obviously clear today that that experiment was grossly unethical. You can't exploit a vulnerable population without their permission, and these people couldn't consent. You can't deliberately give somebody a disease just to study the effectiveness of the cure, and you were pretty sure that the drug was curative. But by the standards of the day, going to a population in prison or going to a population of people in a home for the mentally ill was acceptable. I mean, if we brought those researchers back right now and had them in this interview, they would say, of course, that's where we would do such research. The good news is we've made a lot of moral progress since that time. The bad news is, by the standards of the day, that was probably an experiment that if we'd confronted the people then and there, they would have said, there's nothing wrong with this.
At President Obama's request, the Guatemala affair is now under the study of the Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues. What has the Commission been tasked with?
They basically have two very difficult tasks. One is ascertain as best they can what did happen in Guatemala, who was involved. And I know I've got some of my own students working on this as part of the commission, that they have found that one of the investigators who was involved moved on to the notorious Tuskegee study after working in Guatemala. So there is a continuity of using vulnerable people in the Tuskegee study, poor black African-American men in the South, Guatemala, poor prisoners and mentally ill people. Sadly, tracing that legacy and its impact on research, I think, is part of their charge. It is a reminder in some ways why we do have the protections we do of informed consent and review by committees known as institutional review boards for research. They have deep historical roots in these kinds of events. The other charge they have is to take a look worldwide to see whether research protections in poor countries today are adequate. That's a big challenge. There's a lot of research overseas. It's been growing. There's been a lot of offshoring of studies. They'll try to do a bit of a survey, but I suspect we'll get snapshots of particular places and particular trials. Taking a look at everything that's going on in every nation, that's a difficult, if not impossible, assignment. But that is their charge, make sure that today we're doing things right.
Based on everything you know, Are you concerned at all about how clinical trials might be conducted today and overseen, for that matter?
It's a very good question, and I am concerned. We know, for example, that sometimes a sponsor in the United States or Europe, in one of the richer countries, will take a study into a poor country partly because it will be quicker to do. There's less difficulty in recruiting subjects. You show up in a very poor nation, you have a white coat, you bring some medicine, people are going to see that as something they want to get involved in. Very difficult to recruit subjects here, variety of reasons. Sometimes people are already trying certain treatments. Sometimes the local doctor doesn't want to refer them to a study. But the fact that it's easier doesn't mean that the people in these poor nations really understand what's going on. I have a feeling some of them think it's therapy, not research. The other difficulty is, in many of these poor countries, the situation, let's say, may be so difficult and so threatening to the population that they're going to sign up for anything, no matter what the risk might be of the intervention. You know, it's easy enough for us to say, well, we make a risk-benefit calculation. Do I want to be in a trial for a new drug to treat prostate cancer, a new drug to treat lung cancer? If you're in the middle of a malaria epidemic or an HIV epidemic, and somebody says, well, we have something that might help you, I think it's going to be pretty likely that people will sign up. So I think the informed consent protection, when it's involving very poor, often poorly educated, sometimes illiterate people, not so strong. It requires tough committee oversight, watching the studies closely. We'll see to what extent that's being done. One other area that I think is interesting, we don't want to be accused in the U.S. or Europe or other developed countries of exploiting poor people in studies. What does exploiting mean? Well, at the end of the day, it means we're going to learn something in a poor population, in a poor country, but they're not going to benefit in the long run. Maybe they can't buy the medicine. Maybe it won't be available at all. They don't have any way to distribute it. So one of the issues that I've been thinking about a lot lately is, what do we owe them? Should we say, if we do a study in Ivory Coast, or if we do a study in Senegal, we do a study in Vietnam, we'll make the medicine available to you after the study, if it works. For how long? A year? 2 years? And if we're not going to do that because, rightly, a sponsor may say, we're not a foreign aid department, we're a company or maybe a university, then should we build them a road, build them a water treatment facility, give them refrigerators? It's what I call the left-behind problem. What do we leave behind? Forgetting about informed consent and committee review, if we're doing the study and then coming back here, how can we make sure that we didn't rip them off, so to speak, that we didn't take advantage of their poverty, and what would make them better off? And how far do you have to go? I think that's a very interesting question. It's one I hope to get the commission maybe to venture an opinion on, too.
One cannot help but feel that what began as a very unfortunate story may be catalyzing a very timely review, which, by everything we have just said, you have just said, is more than appropriate at this time, given the globalization of clinical research trials and the various traps that one could fall into before, during, and perhaps even after a trial is concluded.
You know, I think it is going to be a good stimulus to take a look. We haven't had a systematic look at research overseas in poor nations. I would say every year in the past decade, more and more research is offshored or outsourced to poor countries. It's a growing phenomena, partly due to cost, partly due to populations that are naive relative to treatments. If you want to find diabetics who've never had anything, you go to China or India, rural poor people, easier to recruit there than trying to study diabetics here who may have been through 10 drug trials or 10 treatments and in some ways not as don't form as good a baseline for doing the research. But this phenomena of looking at how we're doing overseas, I think, is an important moment in research. You can see democracy movements taking place in the Middle East, North Africa, other places. those people are going to start to pay more attention to autonomy and their rights. Mm-hmm. So we need to get ahead of that a bit and make sure that we are ready to deal with, I think, the poor world turning into the perhaps more developing world.
Change gears a little bit back to the United States at this time. Stem cells.
Something not controversial.
Here again, last year we have learned that public funding, at least, of human stem cell lines is under legal challenge as we speak, and with an uncertain future until we hear from the courts, and that may or may not be the end of the sequence anyhow. What precipitated this crisis to your way of thinking?
The immediate crisis was precipitated by something called the Dickey Amendment. That has been on the books since the mid-1990s. And it basically said no federal funds can be spent on any research involving embryo destruction. It was before anybody had identified stem cells. It preceded the discovery of human embryonic stem cells. That law was never pulled off the books. It has sat there. And that was the basis for the lawsuit that has now been brought to say, even though the current administration has said it will permit money from the NIH to go to embryonic stem cell research, it is in violation of this congressionally passed law, which has been around for a long time. I think the Dickey Amendment should be overturned, but the problem is worse than that. If you're a young scientist, a young MD, PhD, you've got a track record now for the past 10 years of funding is on, funding is off, funding is on, funding is off. It's hard to hitch your star to that particular area with this kind of uncertainty of funding. And some people will say to me, well, if it's so interesting, then isn't there going to be private funding? Not at this level of basic research, there's not going to be private investment. They're going to come later if it looks promising. But without NIH steady and regular support, it's hard for a postdoc or a younger scholar to say, yeah, I'm going to work on embryonic stem cells. So I fear whether or not the court case turns out, however it does, damage is being done to having a sustained American effort in this area.
In what way, if any, is the stem cell debate affected by the advent of so-called induced pluripotent adult stem cells?
Well, you know, in doing stem cell research, basically we're trying to figure out how to get cells to regenerate. There are some in the body that do so naturally. So we have a certain component of cells that will grow back our tongue when we rub it or scratch it. Our gastrointestinal lining is going to grow back. We know that the body can repair certain things. Then we have the embryo, which hopefully you can manipulate to turn into all forms of cells, pluripotent as it's described. And different techniques have come about to clone embryos so that you could perhaps transfer cells back to your own body without having to take immunosuppression if you use cells from a different embryo. And finally, induced pluripotency, taking an adult cell and tricking it. I think all strategies are interesting. I certainly think it makes sense to pursue induced pluripotent manipulation. However, right now, the only way we know how to do induced pluripotency is by basically gene therapy. You're using viral vectors to trick the genetics of the cell to becoming more embryo-like. That has risks. We know that gene therapy can introduce material that you don't want. To understand whether you've made something that's embryo-like, this is ironic, but you need to compare it to what is an embryo if you're going to know what it can do. So you can't dispense with all embryonic stem cell research, even if you can induce it. I'm going to put the ethics case this way. If I'm in a wheelchair, if I have juvenile diabetes, if I'm paralyzed due to spinal cord injury, I want to see all bets on all the numbers, adult, cloned, induced, embryonic. I don't know which strategy is going to deliver in the long run. I don't know which is going to be able to be manipulated in the most facile manner. To not pursue all strategies for injuries and diseases where we have nothing else seems to me to be immoral. And I understand the objections about embryo destruction. I've tried to suggest that maybe we could use embryos at infertility clinics that others don't want for that component. But I think you've got to move this area across on all frontiers now. It's too new. It's not well understood. It would not make scientific or ethical sense to say, let's just pursue induced pluripotency.
Since you mentioned the frozen embryos, what, if anything, can we learn from policies currently in place that deal with the disposition of frozen IVF-derived embryos?
As I've looked at that area over the years, it's surprising to me how many embryos have been left behind, unclaimed, abandoned. Happily, sometimes families get babies and decide they don't want any additional embryos that they may have made. Sadly, sometimes people die. They divorce. Clinics aren't sure what to do with these embryos. The policies about their governance are not uniform. And some clinics are very responsible and will give you a consent form and say, keep it, and I understand I have to renew this every year or 2 years to maintain these embryos in a frozen state. But others don't really get directions about what would happen if someone died or became impaired or simply just didn't come back. I think the fate of those embryos is pretty clear. Abandoned embryos are not going to be used. You do hear ideas every once in a while you could put them up for adoption. People who pursue in vitro fertilization do so because they want to have a biological link to any child. Adopting somebody else's embryo, I think, is not going to work. There are hundreds of thousands of these embryos. If there were 50 embryo adoptions last year, it was a lot. Mm-hmm. I think the embryos all will ultimately be destroyed. And while we don't have a clear consent to their use in research for every one of them, given that they're going to be destroyed, it seems to me better to use them in research than simply to watch them be destroyed. Now, I'd like to see the policies updated so that people could say, if I don't want them or I die or I divorce, they could be made available for research. I think that's prudent. But going backwards, I think the fate of those frozen embryos is sealed, and that's the place to turn to see what we could do research-wise.
Prenatal diagnosis is changing as we speak. Several things are happening. What used to be mostly a focus on chromosomal abnormalities now could, in time, with the advent of affordable genomic sequencing, become a far more elaborate process and, in many ways, richer process. What ethical implications do you see in this potential transition?
I'm really grateful for the advances in genomics, combining with the ability to isolate fetal or pull cells off of embryos outside the human body, because it's almost the full employment act of bioethics. The area we're now starting to talk about, I think, is going to prove to be enormously important in the coming decades. Not tomorrow morning, but in the years to come. We have the ability to make children or begin them outside the body. For the most part, that's been a technique that's been used for the infertile. But if you really started to accumulate enough information on risk factors and propensities, both for diseases and maybe for traits, I could see a day coming when people would start to say, you know, I'm not going to make a baby the old-fashioned way, the birds and bees way. I'm going to start them off in dishes and test them, not because I'm infertile, but I'd like to design my children. I can also imagine people saying, given much better understanding of risk factors and the role that genes might play in contributing to certain traits, both desired and undesired, I'm going to test my fetus at a very early stage. Take cells from the mother's bloodstream, which we can now do, see what's going on, and maybe I'd end a pregnancy if I thought something wasn't the way I wanted it to be. Medicine is going to face a very difficult question. Are we in the business of treating diseases and disabilities, or are we in the business of improving, enhancing, partly for preference, partly for improved function. And we do have sports medicine. We do have cosmetic surgery. It's not like no one has answered that question. But I think lying before us is probably one of the biggest ethical challenges that medicine has ever faced. To what extent are we going to be involved in trying to improve and enhance our offspring, as opposed to using genetic screening as it's traditionally been done to identify disease, to identify disorder?
Thus far, mostly because of the invasive nature of the technology, there was a modicum of selectivity in the application of prenatal diagnosis. You mentioned the fact that we might be moving to non-invasive prenatal diagnosis by capturing and then interrogating circulating fetal cells in the maternal circulation. What unintended consequences, if any, do you see in this seemingly technological shift? But it is, in a way, a new day.
Well, I'll mention one that may seem far out, but I'm going to make I'll take a long shot prediction. Abortion is probably the biggest battleground domestic social issue that the United States has seen, and it remains a very hotly contested, deeply divisive moral question. Once you move toward being able to detect genetic problems, risk factors, not just diseases, but things that might put you at risk, and it's not so difficult to obtain the DNA, either it's out in a dish to start the child off, or you're getting it very early from genomic samples from cells in the mother's bloodstream, I think the debate about abortion could shift too. Are we going to start to insist that people who are going to create children with high risk of disease because of cost must use these screening techniques, must wind up having to undergo, socially sanctioned examination of genetic risk for their children? We have an aging population. Costs are out of control. I could easily imagine a movement start that said it's irresponsible not to test. Moreover, if you do get a result that indicates it's going to be costly, will we shift from do you have a right to end a pregnancy to do you have a right to start a pregnancy?
On a personal note at this point, you have dedicated your professional life to the study of bioethics. When did you realize that this is what you wanted to do, and why?
That's the hardest question you've asked me. I went to medical school at Columbia. I was admitted there from an undergraduate experience at Brandeis University, where I did a pre-med thing, but I'd also done a philosophy major. And when I went to medical school, just getting out into my first sort of clinical experiences, rotating around as a student, I saw all sorts of interesting issues. And I went back and asked the administrators at the time, when do we talk about this? And they said, well, we actually don't really talk about that. You should learn about that from your attending. And I was sort of like, well, the attendings don't seem to be talking about it much either. And I had a very supportive dean who's not with us anymore, but he was the dean of students at Columbia, a guy named Bernard Schoenberg. And he said, look, you have a philosophy background. Why don't you go study further some philosophy, get some graduate study, and see if you can then apply it into this area of medicine. I think that you're right. There are some ethical issues there. So that was the trigger. I had a supportive mentor. I did go down and study philosophy in the philosophy department. I have to add, they didn't know what I was doing there either, but it sort of came together for me. I never finished medical school, but I went on to say, I think this is the area that ought to be developed. So that really was it. Good mentoring, supportive people who said, it's an interesting idea. I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about, but try it.
Can we consider this a scoop?
It's a bit of a scoop.
On that note, sincere thanks to Dr. Kaplan and to you, our viewers, for joining Medscape One-on-One. Until next time, I am Eli Hadashi.